We left off last week, Matthew 7, beginning in 7, verse 7. Ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receives. And those who seek, find. And to those who knock, it shall be opened. Or who among you, when your son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if your daughter asks for a fish, you won't give her a snake, will you? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father, who is in heaven, give what is good to those who ask? Once again, we are not doing an Advent series this year. Once again, we are not mentioning that for the last 1,600 years, God's people have been using this time of year to enrich their souls, have prepared themselves during this month to celebrate the feast of Christmas, have prepared themselves by quieting their hearts, have prepared themselves by stilling their souls, by doing a special reading project perhaps, or doing a special devotional habit, or making a special offering, or performing some private ritual of preparation and devotion so that they could receive Christ into themselves in a fresh new way at Christmas. No, we're not talking about any of that stuff. Instead, I'm talking about things that are corollary to the meditative practice of Lectio Divina that we talked about this fall. And first, I am talking about asking God questions. Last week, we talked about a sticky point for many who are in the faith, and that is this. We believe Jesus when he says that if we ask questions, if we seek answers, if we knock at his door, we will find, we will be answered, the door will be opened to us. And yet, many of us, oftentimes at the hardest times of our lives or in the darkest moments of our souls, we have sought and we have asked and we have knocked, only to find God silent. And so, we begin to examine some of the context behind this dilemma. And significant to our discussion is a paradox in our faith. Because on the one hand, our God and the ways of our God are inscrutable, unknowable. God exists beyond limits, but the questions that often emerge within us do so from the finitude of our closed horizons. Boy, wasn't that a good sentence? I wrote that, and I thought to myself after I wrote it, that was a good sentence. God exists beyond limits, but our questions often emerge from the finitude of our closed horizons. And so, on this one hand, our questions don't matter much at all. But the paradox is that over on the other hand, Jesus makes it clear in this text, and in other texts, in the inner voice within us, the voice of God that would speak to us makes it clear that there is something about asking and seeking and knocking, that the realm of reason, the realm of consciousness, of ego consciousness, the realm of soul awareness, of thoughts and of feelings, of plans and of agenda, somehow God does intersect those things, and we can expect answers to questions in that dimension. We can expect divine revelation, that if we ask, if we seek, if we knock, there are perspectives to be gained. And so, we ask this question, is this a paradox that we resolve, or is it one of those with which we simply live like so many others? And my concern for us as a community is that in the midst of this paradox, going through these times when heaven seems silent, focusing as we have on the importance of silence and that center ring that we looked at in this series, and saying that our body consciousness and our soul or ego consciousness is less significant, and doing this as we have done, that some would stop asking, and some would stop seeking, and some would stop knocking, and that we would suspend our quest for God to intersect the realm of soul consciousness, the realm of ego consciousness, that we would stop our quest for God to intersect our thoughts and our feelings. And so, I'm doing this message on asking God's questions. It is important enough to usurp an Advent message during these weeks. Now, last week, we talked about questions that are formed on this and on the other side of silence. And we said that the former are not worth very much. Questions on this side of silence, not worth all that much. But the latter, questions formed on the other side of silence, are worth a great deal. Because the latter have the potential of linking our minds and linking our hearts with the mind of the universe, with the heart of the universe, with the very mind of Christ, with the very heart of God. We said last week that there comes a point on the spiritual journey when our metaphors for God seem to slip away, fade away. Now, we don't have to hasten to that time. As long as those metaphors are working for us, that is a glorious time. But some find along the way that those metaphors for God, God is like a father, or God is like a bridegroom, or God is like a king, these things start to fade in their significance. And when that happens, we are led to silent meditation, compelled almost. Something happens to us when we meditate. A humility is forged inside of us. We said this last week. And we said that there is a humility forged in us in this process of meditation that breeds an authentic curiosity. Instead of asking questions that are formed from our preconceived ideas about what is good, our preconceived notions about what should happen, our predetermined desires that are formed in what we want, instead of asking questions of God that are enlightened by merely our own internal reality, our own limited perspective, framed within this limited view of what is real, we become, like the first humans, truly curious. And the questions that begin to emerge from within us are more along the lines of, God, what are your ways? What is your heart? What is needed here? What is truth here? What is beautiful in this set of circumstances? On the other side of silence, we said, we practice being our most authentic, our truest selves, our one with God selves, as we quiet our body noise, as we quiet our ego noise, as we quiet these other dimensions of consciousness, we find that we are changed by that meditative process, Lectio Divina. And when we are changed, of course, the questions that we ask are changed. It changes how we think, how we react, how we feel. It changes our instincts. It changes how we live in and respond to circumstances. It changes how we prioritize things. It changes our values. What kind of questions occur to us is changed. What occurs to us that is important changes. And so consequently, we ask different kinds of questions on the other side of silence. When thoughts and feelings, that is, soul consciousness, ego consciousness, is no longer our only way of being human, then we begin to ask different questions. And by the way, if you haven't heard me before encouraging you to take up the practice of meditation, please do feel enjoined, feel encouraged, feel invited, feel pushed, feel manipulated, I don't care, feel whatever it takes, it'll be good for you. And I want to particularly say that to those who are males among us. I have noticed, as a pattern of being, that certain disbalance in terms of the number of people who express interest in Lectio Divina, who express interest in meditation, who are of the female gender. And so I want to say to males as well, you may not believe that, but you also have a soul. And you would want to nurture it. It would be good for you. We begin to ask different questions on the other side of meditation. We are taught from our grade school, in our culture, in our society, that if we work hard, we can do anything. If you work hard enough, sweetie, you can be president of the United States. You can do anything you want to do. And there's enough truth in that that we keep at it generation after generation after generation. However, there's enough falsehood in it that it is destructive to us because we pick up an unintended message from this way of thinking that we are taught as children that can be very destructive. Because while it is true that you are in charge of a lot of things in your life, you are not in charge of everything in your life. And when we are told that we can do anything we want to by force of will, then we assume that force of will is sufficient, and therefore we are now in charge. We are masters of our own destinies, captain of our own ships, and we assume that we must now hold the responsibility for everything. Many, many dimensions of our life, we are completely and totally in charge. But it is simply untrue that we are in charge of the whole thing. We're not in charge of our birth. We're not in charge of our death. We are not in charge of the spiritual gifts that we have within us. We are not in charge of our natural abilities. We did not sit in heaven and select a checkbox like a sushi bar and say, give me these things. It just didn't work that way. These things were not in our purview, not our responsibility. We are not in charge of the aptitudes that we have. We are not in charge of the God-given gifts. And there are circumstances and outcomes on the planet that involve us in which we feel responsible and we are not. There are a lot of outcomes we feel we are in charge of and we are absolutely not in charge of them. So many circumstances we feel the responsibility of bringing to a successful outcome, and it is just not our job. So we go through life having been trained from our childhood, you can do anything, you are in charge of everything, and we become poor judges of what it is for which we are responsible and what it is for which we are not. And so, we find things that we can't change that are not in our area of responsibility. We spend a great deal of energy and effort, and it takes up so much energy that we have precious little left over to then focus on the things over which we do have power, things in which we do have control. It is a reflection of the prayer of St. Francis, who prayed, Lord, give me the strength to change the things that I can, the patience to endure the things that I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference, which is which. So when we enter into meditation, when we come and signal to our God our intention to lay down our thought agendas, to lay down our feeling agendas, we afford ourselves a proper curiosity. And that curiosity is born of an appropriate degree of responsibility. We are appropriately curious about the things that we are not in charge of, and therefore we do not have the answers to. We begin to realize as we walk this path, I'm not in charge of this family. I'm not in charge of this spouse. I'm not in charge of this office. I'm not in charge of these coworkers. Mine is not to have them act according to my predetermined agenda for proper behavior, because if I was in charge of them, they would be bound then to act in a way that is in accordance with my will as the in-charge one. But once I am removed from the role of the in-charged one, then they are no longer bound to line up with my predetermined will. Consequently, it ceases to be mine to fix their problems or straighten out their errors. So, consequently, on the other side of silence, when people cross our plans, cross our agendas, the practice of silence has engendered within us a humility about us so that our questions begin to change. They are no longer motivated by the internal demands that these people must be more sensitive, more polite, more understanding, more rational and reasonable, more hardworking, more fair, more carrying their own weight, more understanding, more forgiving. Because my agenda for them is that they be all those things when I'm in charge, and that is the way that it should be. And when I am not in charge, my agenda ceases to be that which rules the day. And my questions take on a different tenor on the other side of silence, on the other side of humility. Now, my questions are something along the lines of, Lord, I am very unsettled. This person has brought up within me a tremendous amount of internal emotion. And now, Lord, what do I do about my unsettledness? That's a completely different question than one that would be motivated by, Lord, straighten out these idiots. They're not living right. Lord, I know that you are just, I'm having a hard time finding just in this situation. How do I do it? Lord, I know that you are merciful, that you are compassionate, that you are forgiving. I'm having a hard time seeing mercy and compassion and forgiveness in this arena. Lord, how do I live now? What is your heart? Who are you? And then, when we have asked questions informed by humility, we then begin to wait for answers. And we wait as though those answers truly are forthcoming, like God is going to talk to us, like God is going to answer the questions that we ask. Like if we would really seek, we might find. If we would knock, the door just might be opened to us. Now, this process may take days, may take hours, may take weeks, may take months, may take years. But while we wait, what we do is we just become our authentic selves. And if we are authentically pretty steamed up about the way that we're being treated, then what we do is we just go around being steamed up. And if we are authentically hurt, or if we are authentically withdrawing, or we are authentically sorrowful or angry or shut down or any one of a host of emotions that come to us in the midst of these kinds of situations, we just go ahead and live our authentic selves and we quit play acting and trying to act like we are super Christians who don't feel feelings and don't do actions. We just are ourselves. But in the background, while these programs are running on the desktop, in the background there is another program running. Over and over and over again, this program runs. Lord, what is your way here? Lord, how shall I be here? Because what's happening in the background is I'm waiting for an answer to a very important question. And while I am waiting for this answer, what has been the experience of the people of God over a long period has been that God is often at work deep within us. Somewhere down deeper than we are even aware of, the question has not been forgotten. Sometimes we might forget that we asked the question, but the mind of Christ does not forget. The mind of the universe does not forget this question was asked, because simmering down inside of us, the Spirit of God is at work in the realm of those generators that generate thoughts and generate feelings and generate instinctual responses, generate value systems and beliefs. Those things inside at the deepest part of us, the Spirit of God is at work in that realm. And if we listen and if we obey, answers are forthcoming. If we ask and if we seek and if we knock, and if we keep a curious heart, and if we keep a heart of humbled, patient waiting, if we keep a heart that is emptied of predetermined answers, what God should answer and what God should say, and if we keep an authentic curiosity, it is the heart of God to reveal His ways to us. It is the heart of God to show Himself and His heart to us. A meditation humbles us, and humility removes us from the role of being our own gods. Humility makes us people of authentic curiosity. Humility forms within us good questions to ask. Humility, in turn, makes us very good listeners. And once we realize that we are not the mind of God in any set of circumstances and all the attendant consequences that go with that realization, then we become truly curious about what the mind of God is. If my mind is not the mind of God, if my response is not the response of God, then we become authentically curious about what the mind of God would be. You know this in your own life. If someone approaches you, perhaps it would be a child, perhaps it would be someone that works for you. If someone comes to you with an authentic curiosity, you're going to have one response. If someone comes to you with a predetermined agenda of what your answer should be, and they're just trying to get you to say what they need you to say, you're going to have another response, and one of those will be favorable, and one of them will not. People who come to you and listen well to you will learn from you. People who seek after what it is that you know with an authentic curiosity will find that. You know that happens in your own life. It's no less true when we come to God in the same posture. When we come to God humbled, when we come to God curious, and we come to God as good listeners, asking, we will receive. Seeking, we will find. and knocking, doors will be opened to us. Now, there's a lot of reasons why people stop asking questions. As you've gathered, it is my intent that we not stop asking God questions. So I want to address three reasons. Two of them I'll get to today, one I'll get to next week. Three reasons why people stop asking God questions. One of the reasons people don't ask God questions is because they assume that they already know what God wants. When I was in Sunday school, I learned what God thinks about sinners. Okay, I already know what God thinks about sinners. I don't have to think about that anymore. Don't have to ask him. I learned at my first church what God thinks about money and how I'm supposed to act with money and how I'm supposed to think about money. And so consequently, I know the answers to that. Don't have to ask God anymore. I already know the way to handle my mother-in-law. I asked God once a long time ago, and I've got it all figured out. I know how to handle my mother-in-law. I've been round and round with this scoundrel of a husband, and I've talked to God so many times about it. I know everything that there is to know about that on the subject. Everything God would possibly have to say on the subject, I've heard, and I know. Now, the danger of this assumption is that when we say we know the heart of God, we may well be simply masquerading our thoughts and hiding what we really mean. And what we really mean is, I have a strong opinion about this subject. My spouse wants to stop and visit his or her family on our vacation. I don't even need to ask God about this because I already know that God does not want me to put up with that bitchy sister-in-law of mine. That is not the will of God. I've got that established. It's done. I don't even need to ask. So, assuming that we know the heart of Christ, assuming that we know the mind of Christ, the mind of God, it never even occurs to us to ask. The pattern is set. The mindset is solidified. The action-reaction mechanism inside of us is already rutted deeply into my soul. I've got it all figured out. I don't have to ask God. Now, this is not entirely unreasonable. There's a reason why we do this. I don't even bother asking Denise if she thinks sausage would be a good idea in a recipe. I just know that woman and little bits of hidden meat, something has just gone cracky in her mind. There is no way we're going to put sausage in anything. I don't even ask that subject anymore. It never occurs to me to say, hey, should we do Chinese tonight? Yeah, that's never going to happen. I just know that she's never going to go out for Chinese. Certain adventures in the bedroom, I don't even bother asking about anymore. They are not going to happen. I know the answer before I even ask. And so consequently, I don't ask anymore. And there are certain things, areas in which this is true with God as well. I pretty much know, personally, God's view of me and righteous indignation. I know that when I'm all wound up to uncork on somebody and just call them to justice, I know what the Holy Spirit's going to say. He's going to disallow that. It isn't going to happen. So many times, I've been ready to call someone to account for their bad action, ready to call someone to account for their bad attitude, and I'm all ready to go and just point them all the problems with the way they are thinking and living, and the Holy Spirit of God has just stopped me for so long, for so many years. I don't even ask on that one anymore. I just don't get permission to go uncork on people. It's not the will of God for me. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong for everyone forever. I'm saying it's wrong for me, and so I don't even ask God. So, it is possible to know the mind of God in advance. You don't have to ask certain questions, and when that is the case, it will be true. And it will be true, and it will be true, and it will be true until the day when it's no longer true. And then things change. And on that day, it would behoove us to be people who ask. It would behoove us to be people who seek, people who knock. In the Hebrew Scriptures, the followers of God were out in the desert, led by God, and from time to time, they would be following this cloud, this pillar of fire, and it would move. So consequently, if you've read those sections, some of them are quite laborious as you read your way through them, because there's so much time and effort spent telling these people how to set up their camp, where to be, how to put far to be away from the other tent next to each other, get it ready, and it's all designed for one thing. When the cloud moves, we need to be ready to go. And we need to be responsive, and need to be ready to move. And when we move, we need to move in an ordered pattern because we have to move quickly because the cloud is moving quickly. So consequently, we can't afford to get too comfortable. We can't afford to get too settled in. We can't afford to carry too much stuff because at any moment the cloud might move. Now, my own read on the things of God in our own community and for the people of God at large is this, that we would be well served to not be too comfortable in the things that we assume are settled and done. Thank you, Grampy. We would be well served to not be too comfortable in the things that we assume are settled and done. There are some areas, I truly believe, that we have assumed that we know God's mind, and that very thing that we know is in play. Consequently, I believe we are also well served if we would be humble, if we would be curious, and if we would be asking. If you are dead certain that you know God's heart regarding your marital struggles, if you are dead certain that you know God's heart regarding your personality quirks, you might be called upon to ask again. If you are dead certain that you know God's view of money, or God's view of sex, or of service, God's view of virtue, you may be called upon to ask again. In the areas of your life that aren't working, but you keep on doing the things that you've been doing because you know that this is what God requires of you, you may be asked to think again. See, the Pharisees, they thought they knew what God thought. And several generations later, the Puritans thought that they knew that what God thought. And the holiness movement thought that they knew what God thought. And the Pentecostal movement, and the charismatic movement, and the Anabaptist movement, and the Catholic movement, and the Protestant movement, all of them thought they knew what God thought, only to find out a few generations too late that they didn't know what God thought. A meditating heart is a humble heart. And a humbled heart is emptied of preconceptions. And an emptied heart is an authentically curious heart. And a curious heart asks and seeks and knocks. So we don't ask questions of God because we assume we already know what it is that He will say. Second, another reason we give up asking God questions is our proclivity for formulas that will always work every time. Policies are so much easier to work with than this messy process of a day-long dialogue with God. Because a day-long dialogue with God is much more demanding. It demands that I sensitize my heart and be in a listening posture, whereas a policy just means that I refer to the paper. This is what our policy is. This is what we've got to do. A dialogue with God demands that I ask today and listen carefully for an answer, and then ask again tomorrow and listen carefully for an answer. And there's a really good chance that when I get the answer today, it'll be different than the answer I get tomorrow. And that is untidy, and it demands change. And if we've learned anything together, it's that change is painful. We don't like change. So consequently, we love policies. Just tell me how it is that I am to live, and I will live that way. So consequently, I am freed from this odious responsibility of having to ask God questions. I don't have to seek. I don't have to ask. I don't have to knock. I've got a policy right there. It tells me everything that I'm supposed to do. I'm a good Christian. This is what Christians do. Except that good Christians are not much different than good Pharisees. And somewhere along the way, Pharisees quit asking. And they had policies written right there on tablets of stone and parchments. And it said right there, this is how you're to live. And they missed the very heart of God. And we are not any better than them. And without a humbled heart, and with only policies to go on, we run the risk of missing the very heart of our God. Policies are so much easier to work with than this demanding process. I read a story that I think will be instructive for us, so I'm going to read you a little bit of it. It's from the book, When the Soul Listens, by a woman named Jan Johnson. And she, the author of this book, was at a conference when some leaders from a church approached her and asked what their church policy should be. They said to her, "We would really like you to help us hammer out our church policy on baby showers for unwed pregnant women. Because on the one hand, giving a shower to these unwed pregnant women might indicate that the church's stand on premarital sex is one of promiscuity. But on the other hand, we love these women, and we would feel very bad if we didn't give them a shower and if we neglected them." So here we are, kind of on the horns of a dilemma. We need a policy to guide us. What should we do? Would you help us? And so the author asked the women, and this is where I start reading. She said, so tell me the names of these women that you're talking about, and tell me a little bit about what you know about each one of them and their heart toward God. Their puzzled looks indicated to me that they had completely missed my point. In response to their puzzlement, I said to them, now, here's what I'd encourage your leadership group to do. I want you to name each one of these women before God, and then ask the Lord, Lord, if the church were to have a shower for this young woman, what would that tell her about you? You may hear nudges from God that it might embarrass one, but it might affirm another. One might need the financial blessing, while another might have a bad attitude subsidized by the shower. Then I'd ask God, would any of these women need more than a shower? Maybe a standing appointment with one of the leaders to mentor her in her life. In any case, your first answer is to go before God and ask. Listen for input for each one of these young women regarding each one of their lives. Now, our tendency in life is to search for policies that will be blessed by God. If we do the right thing every time and we get God to bless, we've got the best of both worlds. We don't have to waste all of our time doing all this asking, seeking, knocking stuff, but we get the blessing of God also. And so we're looking for policies that are blessed by God instead of doing what is demanded of people who are being drawn by God into intimacy. It is so much more demanding to come and ask and seek and knock, but it's by the very force of requiring that of us, God invites us into this place of interdependent union with Him. Now, the church is filled with formulas. Some of them are for raising kids. You've probably heard three or four on raising kids. I remember one couple coming to our church and just ready to hit me if I said anything about how they ought to raise kids, because they had just been shoved down their mouth in so many different churches that you've got to grow kids this way, or you've got to grow kids that way. This is God's way, and this is what you're supposed to do. And policies can become, for us, quite laborious and burdensome. There's lots of formulas for how you ought to run a church service, how music ought to be done, how sermons ought to be done, how whatever should be done. Lots and lots of policies for that. Formulas for handling conflict. Formulas for distributing the gifts of the Holy Spirit. You got to stay away from this one. You got to stay away from that one. And lots of formulas for distributing benevolence in the community. How is that done? We need policies because someone would take advantage or someone would not get what their fair share would, so therefore we have a policy that applies once and now and for always. And these things are so much easier than dealing with the indwelling Spirit of God in the heart of a community and in the heart of an individual. But I enjoin you. I encourage you. Don't take a shortcut. Ask and seek and knock. In that same book, there was a quote a few pages later from a pastor whose name is Peter Lord. He said this, "When God has blessed others using certain methods, we sometimes presume that we should use those same methods. We don't realize that God blessed that way for others because that's the way He ordered them to do things. Nowhere is this more common than in a church program. One church prays and receives an answer, a specific method of carrying out a certain order of God, and they are richly blessed because God often blesses what God orders. Then another church, seeing that blessing, copies the program because they believe God is blessing the program itself. They fail to realize that what He is really blessing is obedience. They never stop to ask Him, Lord, what is it that You want us to do? May that not be so among us, that we would come to God and say, Lord, where would You lead us collectively? And Lord, where would You lead us individually? Part of the reason why I'm having these prayer gatherings, where I will do four of them and you are encouraged to come to one over the course of each month, is for that very purpose of coming and saying, God, what would You have for us? Where would You be leading us? Now, next week, I'm going to talk to you about what you can expect when you live this way. When you practice meditation, when you practice silence, when you enjoy the fruits of meditation by seeing humility and an authentic curiosity develop in your life, when you ask and don't give up asking, what can you expect will happen? But this week, I want you to feel enjoined. I want you to feel exhorted, encouraged, prompted. Meditate. Don't give up asking God questions. Let your questions be informed by silence. But even if you ask questions that are on this side of silence, questions that are framed by a very limited view of reality, ask and seek and knock. Because even on this side of silence, our God meets us. Even with our metaphors firmly intact, our God meets us. He has stooped so low to interact with us that if he stoops, if he's stooping miles and then he goes an extra quarter of an inch in order to stoop to this side of silence, he does that. It's in his love for us. It is his desire to draw us to himself. So my encouragement to you is even when God delays in his response, even when you feel you know the answers, even when you would prefer a formula, ask and seek and knock. So, Lord, I ask that you would help us be people who bridge the paradox of, on the one hand, your inscrutable, unknowable ways, and on the other hand, these words of Jesus that tell us that you will intersect in the realm of our minds and our hearts. And I ask you, Holy Spirit, to guide us individually and as a community to thoughts and to feelings and to instincts that are enlightened by our experience of your love and our experience of your goodness. I ask that you would birth within us the passion necessary to be steadfast in meditation, that you would stir within us a deep humility and an authentic curiosity for you and for your ways. I ask that you would make us people of listening hearts, people who are askers of good questions and listeners to your heart and listeners for your reply. Be that so among us, Lord. Amen.